The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Anyway, it's time for our Friday Forum, and we're going to look back on the events of a pretty historic week. First of all, the recognition of a state of Palestine, which will be formally done on the 28th of this month. We're joined by Hugh O'Connell, political editor with the Sunday Times, John Lahart, Fianna Fáil Southwest spokesperson on social enterprise, and Senator Lynn Boylan, Sinn Féin spokesperson on climate justice. Good morning and welcome one and all. Hugh, we'll go to you first.
Yep.
The impact in practical terms of this step taken by the Irish government.
Well, I mean, I think we'll see now over the coming weeks what that impact is. I mean, we know on the Israeli side that there is seemingly going to be an effort now to isolate Irish diplomats in the region and restrict their movement in the region. And we have the Israeli ambassador in the Irish Times today suggesting that this would, you know, the NGOs' access in the region would also come under review, I think. So that creates very real problems for the Irish government out there and for NGOs out there, Irish NGOs operating out there. And as a knock-on consequence of that, Irish citizens in the region as well.
You mean that they might not get effective representation,
correct,
if they're in trouble?
Yeah, correct. I would assume so, yeah, based on what the Israeli government have been saying so far. So that's the practical impact from on that side of things. And then in terms of, you know, the recognition of Palestine as a state, and in terms of the, you know, that driving forward the whole two-state solution, I mean, that's never been further away than it is now, arguably. And I don't think what this move, symbolic though it is, and symbolism can be important in diplomacy, I don't think that it drives that forward in any substantive way. And I don't think a few other countries coming on board in the next few weeks will drive it forward either. So a historic week, an important week. You know, the governments will be pleased with itself about this, I think. But there are real consequences and they will play out over the weeks and months ahead.
John, what's your view?
Yeah, I think there is probably, I mean, among a lot of the significant elements of it that would have been discussed during the week, I suppose it does, the issue of Spain, Norway and Ireland recognising formally the State of Israel is a break with what has traditionally been happened, because you had a break between, we'll say, Western countries not doing this, and then other countries from the developing world. There are 143 countries, I think, that do recognise the State of Israel.
Palestine.
And actually, you know, Ireland did recognise the State of Israel. It's a point that is often forgotten in the argument. I actually looked at some English language newspapers this morning in Spain and Norway, just to see what they were saying. And I'm not saying that we can take some comfort, but it is a plague on everybody's house with the Israelis at the moment. They are being as hard on the Norwegians as they are on the Spanish. And the reportage in the Spanish newspapers and the Norwegian newspapers is as critical.
Were they miffed about what happened to their ambassadors?
Yes, very much so.
Being brought in, carpeted in front of the press.
And in front of television and it being filmed. And actually, the Spanish newspapers, just a really interesting thing, they kind of said, look, it is Israel itself, and we know this, that has resurrected the entire conversation about two-state solution and about recognizing the Palestinian state. El País, the Spanish newspaper, just made that statement very concretely this morning, that we wouldn't have got to this point only for Israeli actions. And because of the binary nature of the debate, I have to say clearly in saying that, obviously condemn the attacks of October.
But isn't there, in these condemnations, which are ritual by now, there's kind of almost a by the way, of course we condemn Hamas, however, and we were talking this morning, reminding people once again that the scale of what happened in Israel was 1,200 people killed. The equivalent here would have been 800 killed on the day in terms of population. So what that can you imagine what the reaction in Ireland would be if 800 people were killed by loyalist paramilitaries coming across the border?
Yeah, I can. And one of the things, I've said this in the Dáil, is that, you know, Israel and the Jewish community are a community that have not just faced the threat of annihilation, they faced annihilation.
Yeah.
And living with, so you can understand their desire to defend themselves, that they never want it to happen again, but also living with the fear that it may happen again. I think that's a fact that we just simply forget sometimes in fact.
Maybe we can't realise it. Maybe we don't have it.
It is difficult to conceptualise it. But when parties to the debate and the discussion continuously seek to make it a black and white. If you say this, then you can't say that. If you're in favour of this, then you surely can't favour the other. That's one of the complicating factors.
Okay, Lynn.
Well, I think, look, first and foremost, this didn't start on the 7th of October. I was in Palestine in 2014. I was refused access to the Gaza Strip, and that was following Operation Protective Edge, when Israel had gone in and done what they call mow the lawn, which is every couple of years they go in and literally destroy the infrastructure of the Gaza Strip. And I saw it with my own eyes then, aid being prevented from getting into to Gaza. So I think this is a very significant a step by the Irish government, but it's a testament to all of those groups who have been campaigning in Ireland and across the world to have Palestine recognised. And I think that they deserve credit for it. The reaction from the Israeli state is to be expected. That's what they do. It's the Netanyahu government is a government of bullies, and they try to bully and silence anybody who dares speak about international law, who dares speak about human rights. I mean, there are 40,000 people dead in the Gaza Strip, 70% of them are women and children. And even last night, they went in and they forcibly removed people from one of the hospitals, leaving women in labour. Health professionals being forced out of a hospital and leaving vulnerable women in labour. So we have to be realistic here about the international law, and Israel does not get a byball. It does not get to be immune to upholding international law. And I think that's why it's so significant.
And we shall see what happens with the International Court of Justice later on today.
Absolutely. But the Irish government could go further. They could stop holding up the divestment bill. That's the Sinn Féin divestment bill. They're stalling tactics on that. There's the Occupied Territories Bill as well that they could implement. And they could also be putting far more pressure on the EU around the Trade Association Agreement. Because, as I said, Israel has to know that there are consequences when you break international law.
But Ireland has been doing that on the trade agreement with Israel.
There is a mechanism within that trade agreement that you can cancel it altogether. You don't need to have a review. We know that human rights are being breached. They could just call for it to be ceased now, not to call for a review of it. And in the absence, I suppose, of a consensus at an EU level around that, then they should be introducing the Occupied Territories Bill and the divestment bill.
John?
Yeah, and it's important. Look, one of the points I would make is it's important to distinguish between, and it's a point that Micheál Martin made, and I want to acknowledge the work that he's done as Minister of Foreign Affairs over the last year, particularly, that there's a distinction drawn very much and emphasised by government between recognition of the state and recognition of Hamas, which is, you know, has been called out as a terrorist organisation. As a TD who represents a very small and decreasing Jewish community, by the way, I just want to bring a degree of balance. There's one thing I would have had sympathy with what the ambassador said, is just how uncomfortable the Jewish community feels in Dublin and in Ireland at the moment. And I would have just huge empathy for that. Ultimately, for me, politically, the conversation about all of this probably starts in 1945, as opposed to last year or 10 years ago or whatever. And it is not until, you know, there's always going to have to be dialogue. It is a pity for someone who grew up in an era, for example, when teenagers and people who did their leaving cert or went to college sometimes went to Israel on kibbutzes, that whole scenario has ended. Israel's place in the world seems to have changed a bit. I mean, who, you know, they're facing accusations from the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice. And again, the Plague on All Your Houses piece yesterday in the Jerusalem Times. Again, I was kind of browsing these papers this morning. The German foreign minister got into trouble because he was asked if Netanyahu was in Germany having, you know, and if the ICJ had followed through on their report, would he agree with the German authorities arresting him? And he said, of course. And the Jerusalem Times got the Israeli government again gone mad over that. So there are things I think we need to keep calm about always, that discussions have to take place, negotiations have to take place. The treatment of our ambassador, I think, was
But the question of whether Hamas were actually propagandizing on foot of this recognition.
I think they were, but I think the Taoiseach particularly, I mean, all you can do is take to the airwaves. He was on CNN and he was very forthright in doing that. And that is what terrorist organizations do. But we are recognizing the state of Palestine, not the government of Palestine or Hamas or Hezbollah. And both Minister of Foreign Affairs, Micheál Martin, and the Taoiseach have been very clear in their Dáil statements and in all the public statements over the last number of weeks and months in relation to that.
Hugh?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out now and whether the ambassador comes back here, for example. You know, that she's been brought back as have the ambassadors of Norway and Spain. I don't know, the expectation on the Irish government side is that she will remain here, that the, you know, Israel will maintain its ambassadorial presence in Dublin. But, you know, what retaliation, if any, will come from Ireland to the treatment of its ambassador out there and the isolation of its ambassador out there, that remains to be seen. I mean, is it fair that Dan Ehrlich would have
This morning, and you may have heard on our news headlines at 11, the IDF announcing the recovery of three more hostage bodies. So whether this was fortuitous timing for them, but it's kind of a reminder this is all about.
Well, it is. And I was on Israeli TV earlier this week, and one of the questions they asked is, what is the Irish government doing to free the hostages? You know, and that's a question. I mean, the whole Israeli mentality towards Ireland has been very hostile over the years, but this has intensified it now. And there is a feeling that, you know, Ireland has just not done enough. I mean, it says it condemns October 7th. It says it wants a ceasefire. But it says it wants a ceasefire. It says it wants the aid to be allowed to flow in. And this is not a position that is going down particularly well in Israel at all.
Lynn?
Well, I think a ceasefire is the best opportunity for bringing the hostages home, because let's not forget, the hostages are also being bombarded by military action. They're also subject to the starvation tactics of not allowing aid into the region. So the best thing for everybody is a ceasefire, and that's what we need to keep calling for.
But Hamas is unlikely to give up its hostages. It's the only weapon it has, really. The only card it keeps up its sleeve, because if you give the hostages back, there's nothing to stop a total bombardment, because there's no danger then to Israeli citizens.
But that's why we need the peace process, and we also need to be talking about those prisoners who are being held arbitrarily in Israeli prisons, many of them children, and are being held in very, very poor conditions as well. So we need to talk about the return of the Palestinians back to their homes as well. So this is why we need a ceasefire. This is why we need a peace process. And eventually, hopefully, and we've seen that on this island, is that you can bring people to the table and eventually get a peace process. And I think that's why recognising Palestine is a first step in that, and giving the Palestinian people hope on the international stage. But we need a peace process, we need a ceasefire, and we need the return of hostages on both sides.
Now, the Taoiseach did refer back to our troubles, and he said, in the same way as, you know, Hamas are not the Palestinians, the IRA were not the Irish people.
And the Taoiseach can say that. I mean, the peace process is about...
Do you demur?
Well, the peace process was about bringing lots of people around the table, including loyalists, to the table to talk and have a peace. And that's what we want to see. And that's what we want to see for Palestine as well.
OK, we'll move on to other developments this week. And let's talk about the snap election in the UK, because that's going to stretch Sinn Féin a bit. Elections on all fronts.
We love elections, Pat. that's what gets us up out of the morning, is going and knocking on doors, talking to people. No, I think, look, the Westminster elections, I suppose, gives an opportunity, because if we're looking at the way the polls are going in Britain, that we might get eventually a little bit of stability at Westminster, because the last number of years have been chaotic leading up to Brexit and then post-Brexit, and the constantly changing prime ministers. Sinn Féin will be going out and leading a very positive campaign, hoping to increase the number of MPs that we have, and we'll be making the case to people in the north is that if you want decisions made closer to home, then you vote for Sinn Féin candidates.
Well, the old question of the abstentionism in Westminster, why bother going for election there, given there's so much power vested in the Assembly at home now, executive back up and running, why bother going to Whitehall to take the expenses and do nothing?
Well, we don't take the salaries. I mean, there's the misinformation out there that Sinn Féin MPs...
I said expenses, did I
not? Sinn Féin MPs. And the expenses is because they run offices and they deal with constituency cases and they do work, a lot of work for people that elect them.
What do they actually do over there?
Well, they do lots of work both at a local level, in the same way that a TD would be doing it here, advocating for constituents. They're also out there talking around the peace process, around issues for the North, around budgetary issues. But we have a mandate from the people of the North who elect Sinn Féin MPs, is that they want MPs, and they're basically telling the Westminster government they want decisions made closer to home.
So they don't
and
take
that's
any
how they
salary.
Get the mandate. They don't get a salary.
No. So how do they live?
Well, they don't take a salary. There's no salary.
But how do they earn a living? Are they on the dole? And like, it's a genuine question.
They have expenses for offices, allowances, and that, but they don't get an MP salary.
They get their turning up money.
Yeah.
Okay.
But though they don't go into the chamber.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, John?
You're saying it's not something to subsist on, is that?
Well, I'm just curious. Sinn Féin's salary arrangements and whatnot have always been a bit of a mystery to me.
I'm just, who would have thought that the Tories had a landslide victory only 4.5 years ago? It's hard to believe that Boris Johnson was the Prime Minister. Biggest result, I think, since 1979. This is fascinating. Already some of the, I suppose it's a relief, Nigel Farage apparently is going to be in the States assisting Donald Trump.
Yeah, he said he's actually going to help reform. He's actually going to be campaigning for them. He's given up his broadcasting temporarily.
The biggest thing he could have done, though, was run.
I hear the clucking of a chicken.
Well, you say that. I mean, he's ran in a succession of Westminster elections and never been elected to... Farage is an extraordinary figure that he's never been elected to the House of Commons and yet has wielded a huge amount of influence over British politics.
And he hasn't ruled out interfering in Tory politics after the election, which he predicts.
Well, this is it. But also, reform is the biggest, one of the Conservatives' biggest problems because they didn't run candidates in 2019 in constituencies where the Conservatives were looking to gain seats. But they are running candidates now. So that's going to eat into the Conservative vote.
In the same way as the Lib Dems cost Labour seats over the years as well, acts as a drag in their first pass.
What's all your analysis, Lynn, on why Rishi Sunak went? I mean, it was the end of the line for him no matter when he went. Was it just cut and run? Out of it.
I think you'd give yourself a headache if you tried to understand the mentality of the Tory party these days. I mean,
it's an odd thing to do.
It is a very odd thing to do for him. But look, even the fact that he was told not to hold it outdoors and he held a press conference outdoors, he doesn't listen to other people. I think the positive out of him calling an election now is that we are going to see a repeal of the Legacy Act, which Keir Starmer has said he will do. And I think that's a very positive thing for any future British government.
It's a huge gamble on his part. But I think he figures, look, do it now, get it over with. You could drag it out to the autumn. It might not change the gap that I think is 20 or 25 points.
And then off to California.
And then off to California in the autumn. But I do think that, it's a six-week campaign. There's a lot that can go wrong for Labour. Mm. It's Labour's to lose. They've got the ball. It's theirs to lose. We saw what happened to Theresa May in 2017. Mm. She had a huge lead. She was on course to return 400-plus MPs, I should say, and she ended up in a minority government situation.
Yeah. But it's hard to see that hapless crowd that are running the show at the moment actually impressing the electorate.
It is, Labour does have issues. I don't think Starmer's personal favourability ratings are particularly strong. They need a huge historic swing, bigger than the Tony Blair's swing in 97, more than 12.5%, just to get a majority of
one. What was it, actually, Rishi Sunak was making his speech outside 10 Downing Street, which I think I could hear things can only get better playing in the background.
Yeah.
To answer the first question about why now, I think Sky had a tracker kind of saying he had made 5 commitments when he became leader, that he's kind of achieved 2 of them. The economy's growing, inflation has been cut, making a bit of progress on some others. The 7-week campaign, I think there's over 70 of them not standing again, including our great friend John Redwood, who's decided to step down. I think the tactic there is to really put Labour under scrutiny, to wear people out, to have a very long, drawn-out campaign. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sunak has nothing to lose because, I say, everybody assumes he's going to lose. Your paper this morning actually is saying that Tories are in big trouble, but the result isn't clear-cut.
Yeah.
No, that is in itself sort of extraordinary when you consider the Conservatives. Partygate shipped a huge lot of damage over that. Liz Truss's mini budget, which nearly sent the UK off a cliff and had a very real impact on UK citizens in terms of their mortgages. They're still paying for Liz Truss's disastrous decisions. When you think of all of that, and yet the Labour Party's victory is not assured.
And not a single flight to Rwanda before the election.
No.
Which is a capitulation, I suppose. Moving on to that, and therefore from Rwanda to the banks of the Grand Canal. How should the government cope with this? Because every time you unpitch a village of tents, another one springs up like mushrooms.
I think there's a number of ways. It's harrowing watching that. I produced a paper on behalf of my own parliamentary party in relation to this, of their views. And one of the things was trying to enforce the laws. I think the Thornton Hall style approach is probably going to be the medium-term answer, that the state has to provide space.
But, Minister Fleming yesterday from Offaly saying that there will be a series of these scattered around the country. So you have effectively tented cities around the country full of asylum seekers if 30,000 a year arrive and we're processing them at a snail's pace? I mean, the only thing that can happen is that these grow and grow and grow.
Well, not necessarily. Okay, look, the numbers of Ukrainians leaving is rising significantly.
But they're not intended villages.
No, precisely. So it may free up some accommodation, although we want very definitely, all of us want to see hospitality returning to what hospitality venues are meant to do. I think the number of safe countries, we need to reduce the numbers coming. That is one of the things we need to do. Increasing the number of safe countries, the minister included increased them from 6 to 8. So for your listeners, if a person is coming from a country that's designated as safe, they simply can't seek asylum here. The Dutch have 33 countries listed as safe. We just have 8. And then the rapid processing of those who do come seeking asylum, I think we're increasing the turnaround times for those. But having people in tented villages along the canals, it's unacceptable.
Does designating a safe country mean that as soon as you arrive, if you're from one of those countries, you're put back on the plane instantly?
Well, it should. You can't apply for asylum, put it that way.
Yeah, Lynn?
Oh, yeah, well, I think, look, the current system is chaos, do you mean? Because we've been calling for a number of years now for the government to set out a plan and they haven't got one. And in fairness to Minister Roderick O'Gorman, he's sort of been left carrying all of the responsibility for this. I think what we need to see is definitely a move away from the privately run reception centres or hotels and nursing homes and all of these buildings where you have small number of individuals making very large profits, and move to a state-led reception centre style model. And if you're doing that, you do need to talk to communities and engage with them and treat them with respect and ensure that you're putting in extra resources into those communities.
You also need a UK government that will work with us and work with with the European Union as well in relation to.
Yeah, look, Lynn's right. It's chaotic. It's a mess. Like what's happening down at Grand Canal is ridiculous. Where tents paid for by the government, ultimately the department reimburses homeless charities that give them out, are then cleared away within a week and thrown in the bin. I mean, you know, it's just a very chaotic situation. The Thornton Hall is being seen within government as the kind of panacea here that's going to, you know, create a lot of capacity within the system. It may not be. There's other sites being identified as well around the country. But we've seen some of the problems at those sites in terms of protesters and all of these things. And
including my own constituency.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's a mess. And
that's bomb, by the way, Hugh. That's a serious escalation.
Yeah, it is.
That's moving into terrorist kind of
actions. It's causing a lot of a breakdown of social cohesion around this issue. And I keep thinking back to the government being told 2 years ago in a cabinet memo that this was going to happen and to prepare for this. And there's just a feeling that I get a sense that there wasn't the preparation for this. And I think even when Taoiseach Simon Harris came in, he was kind of shocked at the fact that a lot of things that weren't happening, a lot of meetings weren't happening, a lot of meetings were very irregular around this issue. So he's brought a new impetus to it, but I mean, it hasn't.
All right. We have to leave it there.
Massively.
On that note, Hugh O'Connell, political editor with the Sunday Times, John Lahart, Fianna Fáil, Dublin South West spokesperson on social enterprise, Senator Lynn Boyne and Sinn Féin spokesperson on climate justice. Thank you, one and all. A reminder that our items from today are uploaded as podcasts, which you can listen to in the Newstalk app, powered by Go Loud. Just search for The Pat Kenny Show.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.